Elizabeth Baird is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. And she uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you? How was your, did you get a 3-day weekend?
Yes, I feel like I've had a mini day weekend. I don't remember wearing anything but this sweatshirt for the last 5 days.
And so for people that can't see, you have a very large pink sweatshirt on today.
Thank you.
It's adorable.
Maybe we'll take a photo at the end of the show just so people can see what happens behind the scenes here.
Okay, great. So what's going on? What are we off to today?
All right, so there's, like all shows, there's 3 parts to the show that will hopefully get to one conversation. And I am excited because I have a guest in the studio with me who has been a friend for a very long time, and I thought he'd be the great foil for this conversation. He doesn't quite know where we're going with it. I've kept him in the dark on purpose. So he's going to be hearing the introduction as you hear the introduction today. Thought that'd be kind of fun. Surprise conversation. So I'm going to start with this story. My husband sold one of our cars. It was a little car that my daughter got when she turned 16. My parents bought this car for us, a little BMW, old, in 1989. And she drove it and drove it and drove it and got in an accident and totaled it. It was not a big accident, but it was just like a fender bender, but, you know, in an older car. And my dad had the car rebuilt and gave it back to my daughter, who drove it and drove it. Then she went on in her life, and my husband drove the car for a while. And then our second daughter came through, and she drove the car and drove it till she got in a fender bender, and it was totaled yet again. And my husband had it rebuilt, and then he's been driving it for the last, I don't know, 5 years. So that car has been a lovingly part of our family for a long time. It is a workhorse. But it was time for my husband to have his own car, a grown-up car, and not sit on, you know, a seat cushion that was an old pillow from the backyard. Like, time to grow up. So I've been kind of pushing him lovingly to sell the car, but it's been part of the family, and it protected the girls through accidents and all the arguments of why to never let it go. But finally, my husband posted on Craigslist pictures of the car, and he kept saying, "This is a classic. People are going to want this." I said, "Good, then someone will enjoy this car." And so he posted the pictures, and sure enough, we got lots of feedback. And the young man who he finally sold it to was so excited that he found this car, because he had had the exact same car, same color, same year, and had driven it all over the country. And a year and a half ago, or two, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, he'd been hit by a drunk driver, and that car had been destroyed, and he'd been heartsick and carless ever since. And, you know, he's working his way through school and trying to make ends meet, and he lives, you know, down in Southern California. But he'd been saving, and he finally had, you know, this $1,500 that he had saved and saved. And it had taken him a year and a half, because if you're working and going to school, that's a lot of money to save. And he's so excited about the car, he took the Amtrak up from Los Angeles to Grover Beach, sight unseen, got off the train. My husband showed him everything about the car. He was so excited. I mean, I was almost crying. I just wanted to give him the car because he was so thrilled, and he had saved this money, and he had it all in his cash, and he was so proud that he had worked hard to get this vehicle again. So we sent him off down the road. And of course, I made my husband call him the next day and make sure he got home safe, mm-hmm, and that the car had run well. And he was totally happy. And so that was wonderful. And so there's that part of the story. And then there was the other part of the story is, like a lot of people, we have been Marie Kondoing our house. I don't know if that's the right way to say the reference from the Netflix show of decluttering and some Marie Kondo. Mm-hmm. I think I'm saying it right. But we've been doing this for a long time. I will just say that up front, that ours has been a long, slow process. But the car and things we're moving, you know, out of the house. And we took a whole bunch of stuff this weekend, another loads. But there's so much stuff, and you might have heard the article or the story on NPR last week that said so many people are offloading stuff that the thrift stores are overwhelmed, that there's just way too many donations. And so that's been kind of a struggle, a blessing and a curse, to have everyone making space, but the donations now are overwhelming. Then the third piece is the ongoing struggle with the government shutdown. And all of the heartbreaking stories every day of the people who are living paycheck to paycheck and are now having to make critical choices about medications or food or paying rent. I mean, real life struggles, in the likes that we haven't seen since the Depression, where people were having to make those kind of choices and losing their homes. And so I was trying to connect all of these things. And I kept, let me side note so we don't go down a rabbit hole. I understand that life is expensive, that we have huge pay inequity, that we have gaps in wealth in this country. I mean, we all understand that. And I understand that the playing field is not level by any means. And that, you know, in the 1970s and even through the 80s, you could work a job as a checker in a grocery store and still, for the most part, be able to buy a home and a car and live well, which would never happen today. I understand all of that. But the reality is the economy, the economic world has changed. You know, even though it is unfair and the inequity is there, it is what it is at this point. And we've known this for a long time. We've actually known this since the 80s, that the middle class was only remaining the middle class because of credit, not because of money saved to purchase. That people weren't, you know, in the 50s and 60s, 40s, 50s, and, well, beyond that, until the 80s, people saved for items like a car or a vacation, and then they paid cash and did that. But in the 70s and 80s, things started to shift, and credit card companies got so big and popular, and mortgages, and it was so easy to come by money that people started, without having the cash to back it up, making these purchases. And so things have shifted, and we've known for a long time that it's shifted, and yet it seems that we have not altered the way we live our lives to represent the change in culture. And so that's kind of what I want to talk about today, because I thought of this young man, and I don't know if I mentioned, but his family immigrated here from Syria. And so his dad, you know, was really working hard and not wanting his son to, you know, throw away his money and make sure he had a plan. And the young man had been taking the bus where we need to go in Los Angeles. And if you know Los Angeles, it's not really a mass transit friendly place. So he'd worked really hard. And so I thought about that they came here with nothing and didn't expect anything. And everything has been hard earned from, you know, a low wage pay. And then all of the people and all of the stuff that is getting kind of tossed out and turned over is such an indication of the amount of material that we have consumed over the last few many generations. You know, when would it have ever been normal to have storage units that you paid to keep things that you're never going to use? I mean, that should have been our first clue that we probably were doing something wrong, that we had to create spaces to store things. But then the other idea is that we'd get to the point where we had so much stuff, we were drowning in it so much that we had to get rid of it to make room. And I kept thinking, I wonder if none of those things had been purchased, if that would have been money saved. So I want to have this conversation without it being a finger-pointing sort of thing, like, why didn't you save? I don't want it to feel like that. But to kind of back up and think of our Declaration of Independence, that opening paragraph about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and what did that really mean? It wasn't a guarantee that you would have a cell phone and cable and a car and a house and clothing and vacations. It was just you'd be able to create a life however you could carve it out. However you could make it happen, and hopefully the liberty to do that. And then the pursuit of happiness was about, and that's a whole other conversation. It's kind of tied in, but not really. But the pursuit of happiness was actually secular happiness. What is your faith? You know, the freedom to be able to worship the God of your choice. And that was the definition of happiness. And so I wonder if we need to maybe start rethinking, redefining the good life. Because when we look at life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that was supposed to be the definition of the good life, that people immigrated here or came to the United States or created this country on the idea that they would finally get to live the good life. And for them, it was the possibility of better, the possibility of peace, the possibility of a home. It wasn't the guarantee it was going to be there in their pocket, but the possibility. And then that good life has shifted to where we are now, that I wonder if what we think we need to be okay or how we need to define a good life has been altered in such a way that it's hard to it's hard to get to square one. It's hard to get even. Like, we always think we're behind, or we always think we don't have enough. And just the last comparison before we throw it out there to you, you know, prior to World War II, when we went through the Depression forced people to sell homes. They lost their homes. They lost their land. They lived with family. They relied on their community. They reused tinfoil. I don't know when the last time I reused any tinfoil, but it was, you know, rations were given out for people, and you had to get a coupon to get butter. That would feel, that would be unheard of today. But the people who lived through the Depression carried with them what we call the Depression era mentality. And that formed the greatest generation's mindset all the way through their lives, that even no matter how much money they had, they always felt like they didn't have enough to spend it, or that at any moment they could lose it all because they'd lived through the Depression. But the generation that followed them, the boomers who came in after World War II, felt like there was never going to be an end of money or wealth or opportunity. And even in the face of the shifting economy, that the middle class really didn't have that, instead of changing how we lived, we now are a country that the average person has less than $500 in their savings account at any one time. That that those in their 60s who are getting ready to retire, the majority have less than $10,000 saved for retirement. That it takes two incomes to pay mortgages or rent. That our wages are stagnant, yes. But at the same time, we consider things like cable and phones and computers and new clothing mandatory for our existence. So that's where I am today. How can we redefine the good life? Do we need to? Am I just wrong? And so I invited my friend Michael Jenkinson into the studio with me today. Hello, Michael.
Hey.
All right, so Michael is an actor. Many of you might know him from his years and years at PCPA. He's also a director, choreographer, all-around awesome human being, which sounds like such a childlike term. He's an awesome dude. But Michael lives the gypsy life of an actor. He's in town here in San Luis Obispo working for Slow Repertory Theater, directing and choreographing
Million Dollar Quartet,
which will be opening
February 8th.
Very soon.
Yeah, very soon.
And so I thought, you know, Michael would be a great person to come in and talk to about this, because we have two different perspectives in life. I mean, I'm very rooted, my home, my family, my job, my stuff, mm-hmm. my stuff that I had to clean out of my house. And you've kind of consciously become more and more of a gypsy over the years I've known you, and have devoted yourself to the career of art, I don't know, your arts.
Theater arts.
You've devoted yourself to your theater arts, and you've kind of let go of the worldly possessions. I think pretty much everything you own is in your car.
At this point, yes. Yes. I mean, like, my prized possession is my blender. You know, that's the thing that comes with me everywhere I go, because I will want to make smoothies.
Because you have your priorities straight.
Right. Yeah.
So that's why you're here today, and that's what I'm hoping will inspire people to think about how we define the good life, and what are the things they actually really need, and what could they give up in order to start saving, even if it's just $100 a paycheck, towards that rainy day fund? Because we all could be one government shutdown away from being in trouble, and whose responsibility ultimately is that? This is Elizabeth Barrett, and I am the Reluctant Therapist. And today we're going to be talking about redefining the good life. We'll be opening up the phone lines for your calls at 805-781-3875. You can always reach me on my email, Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find us on our Facebook page. Check out our Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. And you can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, or podcast the show by visiting Apple Podcasts. Hit subscribe, and the show will be uploaded to your device. As always, I'm excited to see where the conversation takes us. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
With a beautiful wife, and you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Letting the days go by, let the world hold me down. Letting the days go by.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. And I'm sure you can hear the reluctance in my voice with this conversation because I don't want it to be a finger-pointing, why aren't you saving? Mm-hmm. Because I understand how challenging it is. But I also think there has got to be some connection between the Depression era mentality that we had and the shift to kind of the growth, I get it now, if it feels good, do it, where we seem to be. So I'm going to throw it to you, and I want you to talk, if you don't mind, about how you kind of went, because we used to, you know, years ago when we met, I don't know how long ago it was now, 13 years ago, yeah. That you at that time had said, I just want to have that house, and I want to have, you know, stability and things and beautiful things around me. And so how did you get to this place of kind of doubling down on, no, I'm an artist, and my craft takes me on the road?
Well, I mean, honestly, it really starts by doing what you love. Do you know what I mean? And that's where that came from for me. And then as you slowly start to whittle down what you have in your sort of, you know, expansive mass, you start to find out what you actually need. And so things start becoming more important, like nice sheets. You know what I mean? Like, I want proper bedding. Like
do you
I said,
travel
my blender,
with your bedding?
I do.
I can.
Yeah. I mean, but I have gotten myself to a place where, like you said before we went on our break, that everything can now fit in my car. And it started by sort of a leaving the Central Coast when I moved back to Sacramento to work for Sacramento Theater Company, downsizing right away. You know, that's where it starts from. But I think I've got two big Tupperware containers that have a bunch of Fiesta ware in them that I really like, that hopefully someday there'll be a place for them to go. But until that someday comes, they're just going to be in a box, you know, and that's okay. You really do start to learn, what do I need? And I think, really, what do I need to spend money on? You know, and I think you're right. We create sort of allowances for expensive laptops and, you know, things of that nature, where we do need to ask ourselves, do you need it? You know, it was a big thing for me to go from having an Apple computer going to a Google Chrome, because it was just cheaper, you know, just but effectively works for me.
Right.
So I don't need
the job.
I don't need to have this high-end computer. You know, that's not realistic. So I think a lot of it is just really gauging what we choose and how we choose to spend those funds, you know?
And to be realistic about the funds that we have. I mean, I think that's part of why I wanted to dig into this, is that although there's pay inequities and wealth gaps and, you know, everyone is struggling, that the wages have been stagnant for years and years, the fact remains wages are what they are. Mm-hmm. And so at what point do we drastically alter how we live so that the wages support us, or we have to make some other choices? Like, how many jobs are you willing to work to keep up the lifestyle that you think you have to have? I want to reintroduce my guest, Michael Jenkinson, because I feel like I rushed through that. As I said, Michael is here in town directing Million Dollar Quartet for Slow Repertory Theater that opens on the 8th. Mm-hmm. And just to set context for people who don't know Million Dollar Quartet.
Million Dollar Quartet is a musical based on an actual historic event. Sam Phillips got Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Johnny Cash together in a recording studio one day, and actually laid down some tracks of them performing. And the story is based on that day. It all takes place in one day in 1956, and you can actually hear the actual footage. You can buy the recording of those particular individuals, and then this is sort of a celebration of all of their music and their relationships, and this really amazing historic moment in arts culture.
So music. Is this, I would imagine, a Tony winner of some sort?
Yes. It won a Tony Award 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and it's a remarkable piece because it's all these, there's four men on stage inhabiting these iconic characters, and they're all playing instruments in the way that those iconic people played. So it's been one of the most unique opportunities I've ever had as a director, because I don't play the guitar. I can't tell them how to do that. I just get to watch this brilliance just come off the stage. I mean, they're just amazing, amazing performers, and We've got some, a lovely man named Ben Abbott is playing Sam Phillips, and a lovely young woman, Abby Campbell, is playing Diane, who's sort of a fictionalized character in the piece. But it's great because it gives a little bit of a feminine perspective inside of a male-heavy piece.
Yeah.
And I always tend to say that I direct everything from a feminist point of view, so it's nice to have her there. And it's just been a blast. So please do come check it out.
So it runs February 8th through...
February 8th, I'm woefully remiss.
You.
Yeah,
okay.
You did. But through the February 8th through the middle of March.
And it's Slow Repertory Theater. And one of the reasons I wanted to reintroduce you and ask that question is because how your energy changes and lights up when we get into that place of talking about your craft and the work that you do. Because that's why you've toned down everything in your life to what can fit in your car. Because clearly, when you get into the groove of talking about creating a new musical or, you know, directing something or acting, your whole energy changes.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it's, my life is driven by my passion for what I do. You know, I'm very blessed. I'm so fortunate that I'm able to sustain a career inside of this business. But it's all from me. It's, you know what I mean? It's every part of me is what I do. And so, yeah, it was necessary. It was actually very necessary in order for me to keep things going, to just really look at economizing not just my finances, but just my stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, just really asking myself, well, why do I need that? Or frankly, I don't want to be finger pointing either, but like, you know, just where does the vanity part of it come in? Like, what part of me wants to have the shiny thing? To say so I have the shiny thing.
Yeah.
So I've had this cell phone now for 2 years. It's cracked all over the place. I definitely need to get a new one, but I am holding back as much as I possibly can from doing it because it still works. You know what I mean? But my vanity wants the shiny.
Which is, I think, if we can admit that too and be honest about our ego being satisfied in some ways about having things or new things, if we can own that, then I think it makes it easier to let go of other items. And it's interesting because you're driven by the work that you do. You'd been working at PCPN on the Central Coast for
11 years, yeah.
And at some point as an actor, in order to grow your craft and get more exposure or more opportunities, you have to make that tough choice of letting go of kind of your sure thing and going to different companies and going from gig to gig. And what is that like?
Right now it's great because right now it's going well. You know what I mean? Right now I know what's happening through 2020. But it is, you know, it's always staying one foot in front of the other, you know, just really making sure that you're staying connected and getting those jobs booked. And, you know, I'm not somebody who's happy when I'm not working. So it's finding the ways that you stay really interactive in your theater arts community. So I do a lot of teaching as well as directing, choreographing, and acting, trying to do some admin stuff on the side. You know, you gotta stay at the game.
Be relevant.
Be relevant, stay informed. And hopefully one day there will be a shiny little apartment of my very own, you know, but the vision has changed. Like when I talked to you 12 years ago, it was the white picket fence and the house and the dog and the kids and all that stuff. There's never going to be children. Dogs take a lot of energy. if I could have a studio apartment, I would be very, very happy.
Just a place to land every now and then.
Just a place to land and that I can decorate in a way that makes me feel good. But the need for the three-bedroom house and the, you know, the kitchen and all that stuff is just sort of, it's just sort of gone away. It doesn't seem necessary anymore. Space seems necessary. But, you know, you would be amazed by how many people in my industry are renting rooms. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I have the good fortune of having some friends in Sacramento that I can stay with while I'm there working for STC.
Sacramento Theater Company.
Sacramento Theater Company, thank you. You know, while I'm there 9 months out of the year. I know friends of mine who are in their late 50s, 60s that are still renting rooms because they're still driven by what they want to do. Although the arts, unless you really get into the right position, are never going to fund you the way that you would hope for them to, you know? So.
And I guess that's part of the other piece of the conversation is, at what point do we take responsibility of our economic reality? Like, it is what it is, and what are you willing to actually give up, change, do, so that you have some security, so that you have, you know, money in the bank for a rainy day? I mean, that seems like such a corny thing our grandparents said, but we're seeing now the repercussions of people not having rainy day funds, and there isn't a backup or someone waiting there to help you. I mean, yes, there have been places that have opened to share food and food banks, but it ultimately it's on us at the end of the day mm-hmm. to be responsible for that. But then the other piece is wanting to do the work you want to do. You know, should I take a job just because it gives me financial security and it's going to give me that rainy day fund? And I think, again, that goes back to each of us having to take responsibility for our mental health mm-hmm. and well-being. Like, you and I used to joke about you wanting to give it all up and manage a Lululemon store.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that was a great fantasy because that would be economic security and you'd go every day and you'd know what to do. Mm-hmm. But how long would that fantasy really sustain you?
Right, it wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? That's why we always laugh about it, because it's when I get frustrated and I'm like, I just want something that feels consistent, you know. And I am fortunate that I kind of have consistent companies that utilize me annually.
But you've had to hone those relationships,
absolutely,
and struggle to make those relationships. And well, I mean, they didn't just come to you out of the blue.
No, and I think also it's very important as you're looking at things, especially for people who are kind of paycheck to paycheck, you know, you've got to really be accounting for everything. You know, like I'm about to walk into, as I was saying to you before we went on the air, 6 weeks of being unemployed, with the exception of some teaching that I'm going to be doing. And so really having to look at what are those expenses going to be. And one of the things that was interesting about coming back to the Central Coast after being gone for a year and a half, it was so wonderful to come back. I mean, you forget how beautiful it is. But, you know, one of the big things for me was I don't need to go to these restaurants again. I've done that. You know what I mean? I don't – what are the touristy expenditures that I probably would have in an earlier part of my life done that now I'm like, I don't need to do that. I need to be thinking more about what is going to be cost effective for the future.
And needing some money to get through those 6 weeks, which
absolutely.
I think – Tyler and I were talking before the show started, and when he said, what's the show topic today? And I kind of threw it out to him. The first thing that came out of his mouth was, well, no one teaches us to do that. No one teaches us in school to budget, or that we don't need to go to Starbucks, or we don't have to go out to brunch, you know, or that we should put the rainy day fund aside. Right, Tyler? I mean, you went to school in New Orleans. Did they have a home ec section for you?
I went to school in Texas, actually. Okay. And we definitely didn't have, I just always think that budgeting would be an important class with everything else, like a nice half semester where they teach you, you know, how to balance everything out and balance a checkbook and put money away, because it's taken me, like I told you, about 35 years to figure out how to do that. So,
but and isn't it interesting that at the time we started kind of taking away that part of our education system, because we had home economics and teaching people about budgeting and saving for a rainy day. And I remember my parents taking me to open my first savings account with my passbook and, you know, developing that kind of relationship with money. It's interesting that those habits culturally and that education went away at about the same time we started ramping up.
Yeah. I mean, I was having this conversation with my roommate the other day, just to take it to another level, is that we said we don't really realize how many subscription services that we're on anymore. Like, I actually don't know. Like, I have to go back through and like, oh, I have my Netflix, my Hulu, my Spotify. And do I need all of these?
That is such a great point, because I didn't – that one I wouldn't have thought of, but I know that I am paying for some of my kids' subscription services that probably need to be on their own.
But yeah, I mean, that's so true. Like, you don't think about those expenditures, but I've
how many apps do you have running right now?
Oh my gosh, so many, you know, and yeah, Netflix, Hulu. I'm a British television fanatic, so I've got Acorn TV and BritBox. And what you don't think is you go, oh, it's $6.99. But it's still $6.99. You know what I mean? And
no, because once you add that all up at the end of the month, if it's $60 a month, or let's say $100, mm-hmm. that $100 at the end of the year could have been some, you know, cash towards a car or your rainy day fund. And I think it's that simple math that we needed to teach children, that we keep needing to remind ourselves, that you know, the young man who came and bought my husband's car, mm-hmm. for a lot of people, it's like, oh, it's $1,500. It took him a year and a half to save that. Well, yeah, it did. And he was super proud. So we have to go back to appreciating how, if you're working minimum wage, how long it takes.
Yes, it takes a long time. And then, you know, the older we get, the more overhead we have. That's just how it goes, you know. I'm in a fortunate position where I own my car now. I'm in a fortunate position where I don't have rent right now. But when I was on the Central Coast living here, I had a car payment. I had rent for my adorable one-bedroom apartment, which I miss terribly. And, you know, but we don't think about all those extra things that we think are the norm. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's right, who doesn't have a Netflix account? You know what I mean?
It's true. And it's the same with our phones and the phone service. You know, mm-hmm. right now, no one would think of just having a flip phone to make calls. You have to be paying to have all of the services. And I guess, you know, I like having those things. But if my husband and I lost our jobs, there's a lot of things that would go very quickly. And because I guess we're older and we lived many years without them, I wouldn't miss them as much. But I think younger generations behind us have started to, their lives have been built around brunch and apps and these $10 a month expenses that add up to owning a pet. I just signed on too.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Every young person that wants to immediately get a pet, but vet bills and food. Again, that's it doesn't seem like a lot on the surface, but you add it to everything else, and they become, well, everyone deserves a pet, but do you?
Well, and there's always the unknown expenditures, too. You know what I mean? Like, I can think that I'm financially set for 6 weeks, and then something will just happen.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And then you're like, oh, well, now I'm broke, you know?
My husband always laughed that as soon as we saved $1,000, guaranteed $1,000 something would break.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt. If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is Michael Jenkinson, artist, director, actor, choreographer. He is here in town directing Million Dollar Quartet at the Slow Repertory Theater. We're talking about fiscal responsibility. Who is ultimately responsible for our economic well-being? Is it just unfair, or do we have to do some depression era tightening of our belts? Our number is 805-781-3875. Hey, Bill, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
I guess I got a short little adage that I'd like to add to your conversation. I was a child of the children of the Depression, and it kind of stuck with me, and I've passed this on to my kids. But anyway, it goes like this. If you want to be rich, pretend you're poor. If you want to be poor, pretend you're rich.
I like that, Bill.
That's great. I want a T-shirt.
Okay. That's it.
It's nice to hear from you, Bill. We've missed hearing you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, there you go. So that simply wraps up the whole show into one safe.
But I think it's really wise. Do you know what I mean? That's a lot of really good advice in one sentence. You mm-hmm. know, just don't act like you have something you don't, you know?
And I guess also we forget maybe how exciting it is to have saved money and to go buy something.
Oh, my God, the consumer hug. Yeah, it's, you know, it's like when I walk in Starbucks, I want to buy every single mug that they have there because there's that wonderful feeling of getting something.
Yes, and then the high goes away really quickly, and then
really
you don't have the money, mm-hmm. and then you end up taking it to the Goodwill. You know, that's what keeps going through my head is seeing articles about the donations swamping all of these agencies because so many people are clearing out their homes. And how much money does that represent that could have been stashed away for emergencies?
Part of my sort of decluttering mm-hmm. Was going through, because I'm a dancer, was going through a whole bunch of my old dance clothes. And just looking at how many dollars I had spent at a certain store that shall remain nameless made me want to cry because I was like, and now I'm throwing this all away.
Yeah.
You know, and now that I've discovered these Adidas pants that are $35 online, I'm like, why would I ever have thought that it was necessary for me to spend $150 on a pair of pants that I'm going to jump around and sweat in? Like but.
And the marketing is so powerful. And I think it does all go back to that kind of post-war sense of of growth and stuff, and you know, the more the merrier, and there's always gonna be more. And I remember when we bought our first house and my dad had said, you know, make sure you stretch yourself, you know, buy something a little over your head, because you can expect that your incomes will grow and that you'll grow into that payment, it'll get easier. Unfortunately, that wisdom of my dad's era didn't really pan out for our generation, because everything got kind of stagnant and the house always was a little over our head. And so those were some great lessons learned, but it was a reminder to me that, you know, things have changed economically, and the reality is we need to change our mindset about how we spend money. I mean, I don't drink coffee, so I feel bad saying this, but I think Starbucks is one of those horrible wastes of money. If you spend $5 a day, just if you saved the Starbucks money in a jar, what could you do at the end of the year with that money?
One day a month ago, I sat down and added up how much I spent at Starbucks, and it was mind-boggling. And this was a very – I have a green tea in my hand right now.
We're shaming Michael for his Starbucks purchase.
But it was a very conscientious choice to say, I'm going to spend $3.45 on that green tea that I could go to Trader Joe's and buy a box of for 99 cents. You know what I mean? Like It is that is one of those expenses, or not doing food prep, or, you know, eating lunch out every day, all those kind of things, which I want to do. You know,
so
San
badly.
Louis has all the great restaurants ever. But you just have to be really, really frugal about what are your luxuries. I guess that's another question. What really... And I'm in the process of redefining this for myself, but okay. Like, really, what are your luxury items?
Yeah, what is your good? And I think that was the top of this hour conversation. How do you define the good life?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really allocating, for me, it's mm-hmm. allocating funds for things like, I know because I'm a dancer, but I'm a 40-year-old dancer, I need a massage every once in a while. Mm-hmm. You know, putting things away for my physical well-being, you know, really... looking at the things that are going to be important to me in order for me to feel like I'm living a fully realized life, you know, without, because you don't want to feel so tight.
No.
You know what I mean? But there's got to be some sort of medium by which you judge, you know, what are the things that are going to be good for me? Dance shoes for me, running shoes for me, you know.
Yes, if you save for one great pair of running shoes that you wore every day. Mm-hmm. Be much more important in the long run to you than the clothes that you never see. And it's interesting because in the cleaning out of stuff, I went through all of my husband's kind of closet of things. And it became apparent to me really quickly that I would wash the clothes, fold the clothes, put it on the bed, and then he would wear the clothes on the bed. And then I wash and fold and put them back. But nothing in the closet was ever getting worn mm-hmm. because he was just recycling through what was right in front of his face. So I thought, why is any of this even here then? Because we could live on, you know, just whatever these 5 days worth of clothes are. And again, it's not like I've never thought these things before. It's not that I try not to be aware or teach them to my children. I think with what happened with the government shutdown and just the enormity of the amount of people who cannot make it if they miss a paycheck hit me really hard. And I got afraid for my children and for, you know, anyone I care about. It's like, how many people would be in that space? And we talk about preparing for earthquakes or preparing for a disaster, but we don't talk about preparing for a financial disaster. I mean, you'll hear, you know, people who do financial shows tell us to prepare for a financial disaster, but everyone kind of rolls their eyes and think, nah. Mm-hmm. But truly, if we're taking care of our mental health by getting sleep and writing in our journal and getting massage, if we're taking care of our physical health by eating well and getting sleep, then our financial health has to be equally as important, our economic health, because our economic well-being is the number one cause of mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's the number one cause of physical stress. And so we have to be, you know, spending as much time being honest about our economic reality and how we do things as a culture. You know, I know it's not a popular stance, but at a time, families lived on one income. And they might have had two people working, but they kind of lived on one income and maybe put the second income away. Or one person worked and the other person stayed at home. And the reason that provided more economic security is because if someone ended up losing their job, if the primary breadwinner ended up losing their job, there was a second adult in the home that could help out, that you had the potential to get that income. And that's mm-hmm. how we defined safety net all the way through the 70s and 80s, was until the 70s when that started to shift, was that that economic safety net was that second adult, that second potential for an income. And with the rise of two-income families, then the cost of childcare becomes exorbitant. Mm-hmm. And so families are having to, you know, pay attention to, can I afford to go to work, or how do I care for my child? And then you mentioned then some people just choose not to have children. Mm-hmm. And then when it came to, you know, watching television, we had the rabbit ears and three stations. And now, you know, the cable bill is over $200 for a lot of people. And it's great, and it's nice that it's there. But how long would it take us to get used to not having it for the sake of having money set aside? I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And this conversation is going much too quickly today because I look down and we've just been carrying on. But I want to make sure we open up the phone lines to invite you to be part of the conversation, 805-781-3875. We're talking about preparing for that rainy day, taking financial responsibility for our lives, choosing how to live that good life. Do we choose a career that we love and live poor? Or do we choose a career that sustains a higher level of living? We have to choose it and own it. We're going to take a moment to catch our breath, and we'll be back to open up the phone lines again and take your calls. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Listen as your day unfolds. Challenge what the future holds. Try and keep your head up to the sky. Lovers, they may cause you tears. Go ahead, release your fears. Stand up and be counted. Don't be ashamed to cry. You gotta be bad. You gotta be bold. You gotta be wiser. You gotta be hard. You gotta be tough. You gotta be stronger. You gotta be cool. You gotta be calm. You gotta stay together. All I know, all I know, love will save the day. Said, read the books your father read, trying to solve the puzzles in your own sweet time. Some may have more cash than you, others take a different view. My, oh my, yeah. You gotta be bad, you gotta be bold, you gotta be wiser.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and we're talking about fiscal responsibility and making ends meet and appreciating a dollar, just like my grandmother would have said to me, need to learn to appreciate a dollar and what that dollar can bring, because I think we kind of scoff about, oh, that's only going to be $1,000. That's, you know, I wouldn't work that hard to save that. You can't do anything with $1,000. But if the majority of the American, I don't know if it's a more majority, so I'm going to say that, but a great deal of the population of our country doesn't have $500 saved, let alone $1,000 saved for an emergency or rainy day.
Yeah, well, you know, you're always just waiting for what's going to go wrong. you know what I mean? It's like I said earlier in the episode, that, you know, this, well, and you said, you know, the second that you have $1,000 saved, an $1,000 expenditure is definitely going to come up.
Yeah.
You know,
you can count on it.
Yeah, you know, you absolutely can. But I do think that it's, you know, it's again, it's about trying to figure out what do you need and what do you not need. Mm-hmm. What are the things that are really important to you?
And I think, too, it goes back to the job choice, and that's why, or the career, the vocation, why I called you, because you have that job that depends on being flexible, living below poverty, uh-huh. and being able to be okay with that, and so that you're getting enough emotional satisfaction to sustain you, uh-huh. you have to, the work you're doing has to be almost like a calling.
Absolutely, yeah. No, you definitely know when you're making some of these choices that you're doing what I can say I was put on this planet to do. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. This is why I'm here, and this is what I do, and I can't imagine another way of living.
And it's interesting because in an era gone by, and I think in some ways still at this time, that the entertainers of the world lived on the love of their patrons. Mm-hmm. So you would have housing by someone who loved your arts, or they would help fund your life. I mean, it was a whole different commerce at the time. Our number is 805-781-3875. And Tammy, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Just wanted to make a plug. There's a book called Millionaire Next Door, and I sort of was raised by that. Are you familiar with the book?
I am not.
It talks about a man who doesn't look like he's really got much, but he, you know, he's got a Montgomery Ward credit card in his wallet, and he just has it, you know, kind of a modest little car, and he lives next door to the doctor who's overextended and got the fancy new car, and really, who is a millionaire? It's actually the guy with the Montgomery Ward, credit card. My mom was a single. I was raised by a single mom. She was a Depression era child, you know, farm girl. She was not a single mom by choice. My father died, but I am a single mom by choice, and I've been raising my child on that sort of philosophy. She sort of financially cut me off at 16, and I put myself through school, and I just worked. I've worked since I was 16, and I have just saved and had that philosophy of, you know, always have something under your pillow, you know, always have something under your mattress. Mm-hmm. I bought my first house at 30, my second house at 33, my third house at 34. I'm scrimping and saving away, and now I just feel like I have something to share and teach my child, who I'm now raising on my own, who by choice. We live modestly. We don't have internet. We don't live frivolously. And I think that those values are gone. We never buy new cars. And I just see people all around me buying, you know, overextending themselves and constantly, you know, complaining about being, you know, oh my gosh, I'm in debt. I don't have any money. Well, I don't know. It's like, I think we're doing this to ourselves. I am so grateful, so, so grateful for my mom for instilling in me these values that I at once resented. And now I'm just forever grateful for the Depression era raising.
Tammy, you are my hero. That's phenomenal mm-hmm. that you've been able to save and scrimp and provide this. And what a great role model for your child.
Thank you. Yeah, love your show. And just wanted to kind of hopefully add something to it.
No, so. You did. Millionaire Next Door.
I'm going to go buy a book.
Millionaire Next Door. It's I read it a long time ago, and it does. It just talks about, you know, like my son, he gets a small allowance, but a third of it goes to college, a third of it goes to special, and a third of it goes to fun. So he's allowed to spend, you know, a little bit on fun, but he's also saving for college. And it's not if he goes to college, it's when he goes to college. And, you know, I put myself, you know, fully through college. I was starting to save for college at 16, and it was never a question of if I went to college. My mom didn't go to college, so it was just a question of when my brother and I were to go to college, and we both graduated. So I just think that if you instill in your children these values, anyone can do it. It isn't rocket science. It's just a matter of just keeping your eye on the prize and, you know, just sticking to it and sticking to these values and setting that example.
100%. Tammy, thank you. I'm just going to sit in awe of your success, because here's someone who's actually walked the talk of the story. Mm-hmm. And Jim, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jim. I was just listening to the lady.
No, that's me.
I guess I'm diametrically opposed to the opposite of what Shurter brought to you. I like the idea of frugal and frugal living and what you've been talking about in that way, and a minimalism. But I think the larger conversation is often lost. And it just came out from, I believe it's Oxfam yesterday or today, a report that 26 individual billionaires have as much money as 50% of the entire population of the planet. So, you know, I think that a lot of that conversation is just passed over as that's the way it is, and we need to live a different lifestyle because of that. And there's not, and with K Street in Washington influencing the politicians, there doesn't seem to be a vehicle, and even in mass media, you don't see it, where they go after those people and the crimes and the general things that they've done to get into those positions on the mass public. And there's never an overall conversation like that. And of course, you know, NBC is owned by General Electric, and
and on and on and on. So you don't hear that in the mainstream media, and you might hear it, you know, Amy Goodman or somebody like that, Rachel may talk about it a little bit, but you don't hear a conversation about the root of the problem of the hoarding of the wealth. I mean, you can take Norway or Sweden as a model and say a 50% tax, we're only as strong as our weakest citizen, and they seem to deal better with certain issues socially by providing that it's a right to be able to go to college. It's a right to be able to have health care. It's a right to be able to have housing. And then if you want to open a yacht company and start building boats and make more money as an individual, then above and beyond that for every one of your citizens, and you have that initiative, then you can go ahead and do that. But the conversation always seems to be lost about why we're in this economic position. And if you're from South Central LA or Detroit or lower side of Chicago, and some places in the South, then what really are your real opportunities to do some of the things that this lady was talking about? And nothing against her frugalness and her ambition. I think that's great. But are those opportunities really realistic for most of the people that are poor in this country? I really don't think so. And I'd like to see more conversation about what's going on at the top, why we're in this place, and how we got there, and how the heck we get out of it.
I agree. And, you know, I appreciate that, Jim, because I'd hoped at the upstart of the show I had said I'm not overlooking or denying the inequities that
drive. And you did.
I want to bring that because that is the elephant in the room. We all kind of stare at this feeling helpless. And last night I was watching Rachel Maddow, and she talked a lot about the sanctions being lifted on this Russian oligarch and just the millions and millions of dollars. And I looked at my husband and I just said, this makes me so sick and I'm so helpless. And so I try to turn that into something I can do. And the part of me is like, I can fight the fight against this, like you're trying to say, we need to have these conversations. But then I try to be a realist as a therapist. It's like, what do I do on the floor, on the ground level with people that I deal with every day? Because if we can't change this immediately, then the people who are suffering continue to suffer in hopes that things change. And so I'm trying to cover two things at once.
And I understand that. I mean, I think we all kind of got to take the Ginsburg approach, you know, Ruth Bader, you know, you fight that first battle, you know, you win that first battle, or you spread the word, or in every conversation, instead of necessarily talking about how frugal you can be, you talk about, yeah, you know, these guys are super, super wealthy, and it's not right, and they're not taxed, and they're lobbying our politicians, and we have no say anymore, and all that. But winning that first battle against all odds, it leads to winning the next battle, and the next battle, and the next battle. And I don't know if you saw the movie about her, but that was fabulous. I think it should be required viewing.
Agreed.
But, I want to see on public radio, television, media, at every point, small county, nationwide, more conversation about these guys that really are in control of our financial futures at this point. I mean, as a country, as a nation, and individuals.
Agreed. Thank you, Jim. And, you know, it's interesting because I would maybe spin it the other way. I'd rather have us all live incredibly frugally so we don't have to be caught at the whims of the people who are pulling the strings economically. And if we all were living frugally enough that we weren't paycheck to paycheck or as close as we could be, because I understand opportunities are not fair. I get all that. But for those that could get a financial stability set underneath them, then you'd have the energy and the opportunity to have the bigger conversations. Mm-hmm. But I think part of the problem, the spin, is that everyone is treading water so quickly and trying to stay above water that we can't fight any other fight. So I think we need to, you know, get the foundation set and then maybe be able to go from there. David, thanks for waiting. You get the last word today. What's on your mind?
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to say I'm really enjoying the topic.
Thank you.
It's so beautiful. But I just had a little Thoreau quote from some of Henry David Thoreau's writings. And it was, I was rich, if not in money, in summer days and sunny hours, and I spent them lavishly. Because finances are not going to help us. You know, these wars and these battles, we need to live with each other and find the precious moments in each other. I'm so jealous of somebody having all their possessions in a car. Oh, my God, I love it. You know, other people are hearing that going, ooh, shoot, a blender. Yeah, that sounds good.
It's a serious blender, my friend.
Yeah, exactly. And the other little short one was from Thoreau, because, you know, he built his house for $21, and he systematically wrote down how much everything cost and where he got it and how he built his little place on Walden when he went out there. But the other one is Ah, Nature, the mere remembrance. Mm-hmm. I come to thee like a hungry man to a crust of bread. So I thank you so much for your show, and you guys are beautiful humans. Oh, I love it.
Thank you, David. I don't think there's anything we need to add to that then.
No, that's lovely.
Food for thought. My friend Michael Jenkinson, thank you so much for coming in today. Michael is directing Million Dollar Quartet, Slow Repertory Theater.
Yes, opening February 8th.
Tickets can be found
on their website.
Slow Repertory.
Walk up at their box office as well. And
don't miss it.
Don't miss it. It's
save your pennies and enjoy an evening out.
Yes,
because it is those simple pleasures. And thank you as always for being a part of the conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Find me at Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Our Facebook, our Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. Previous shows at kcbx.org. Podcast our show. Pass it on to friends. Write a review. And I look forward to seeing you next week, same time. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.